Another Sherlock Holmes adventure. Introduced by Dr. Watson, this one's called The Noble Bachelor.
It was a few weeks before my marriage, during the days when I was still sharing rooms with Sherlock Holmes in Baker Street. I had remained indoors all day, for the weather had taken a sudden turn to rain with high autumnal winds. The Giselle bullet, which I had brought back in one of my limbs as a relic of my Afghan campaign, throbbed with dull persistency. With my body in one easy chair and my legs upon another, I had surrounded myself with a cloud of newspapers. When at last I had saturated myself with the news of the day, I tossed them all aside and lay listless, speculating lazily upon the huge crest and monogram on the envelope upon the table which awaited my friend's return. Well, Holmes, here's a very fashionable epistle. Your morning letters, if I remember right, were from a fishmonger and tide waiter.
Yes, Watson. My correspondence has certainly the charm of variety, and the humbler ones are usually the more interesting. This looks like one of those social summonses which call upon a man either to be bored or to lie. Oh, come. It may prove to be something of interest after all.
Not social, then?
Distinctly professional.
And from a noble clan?
One of the highest in England.
Oh, my dear fellow, I congratulate you.
I assure you, Watson, without affectation, that the status of my client is a matter of less moment to me than the interest of his case. It is just possible, however, that that also may not be wanting in this new investigation. You have been reading the papers diligently of late, have you not?
It looks like it. I've had nothing else to do.
It is fortunate. You will perhaps be able to post me up. I read nothing except criminal news in the agony column. The latter is always instructive. But if you have followed recent events so closely, you must have read about Lord St. Simon and his wedding.
Oh, yes, 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 with the deepest interest.
The letter which I hold in my hand is from Lord St. Simon. I will read it to you. And in return, you must turn over these papers and let me have whatever bears upon the matter. This is what he says. My dear Mr. Sherlock Holmes, Lord Backwater tells me that I may place implicit reliance upon your judgment and discretion. I have determined, therefore, to call upon you and to consult you in reference to a very painful event which has occurred in connection with my wedding. Mr. Lestrade of Scotland Yard is acting already in the matter, but he assures me that he sees no objection to your cooperation, that he even thinks it might be of some assistance. I will call at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And should you have any other engagement for that time, I hope you will postpone it, as this is a matter of paramount importance. Yours faithfully, etc. It is dated from Grosvenor Mansions and written with a quill pen. The noble lord has had the misfortune to get a smear of ink upon the outer side of his right little finger.
He says 4 o'clock. It's past 3 now.
And I have just time, with your assistance, to get clear upon the subject. Turn over those papers and arrange the extracts in their order of time, while I take a glance as to who our client is.
All right.
Here he is. Robert Walsingham de Vere St. Simon. Second son of the Duke of Balmoral. Arms azure. 3 caltrop in chief over a fist sable. Born 1846. Well, that makes him 41 years of age. It's mature for marriage. Was undersecretary for the colonies in the late administration. The Duke, his father, was at one time secretary for foreign affairs. They inherit Plantagenet blood by direct descent and Tudor on the Distaff side. Well, there's nothing very instructive in all this. I must turn to you, Watson, for something more solid.
I have very little difficulty in finding what you want. The facts are quite recent. The matter struck me as remarkable, but, well, I fear to refer it to you, as I knew you had an inquiry on hand and that you dislike the intrusion of other matters.
Oh, you mean the little problem of the Grosvenor Square furniture van?
Mm.
That is quite cleared up now. It was obvious from the first. Pray give me the results of your newspaper selections.
Yes. There was a paragraph in one of the society papers. Yes, here it is. There will soon be a call for protection in the marriage market, for the present free trade principle appears to tell heavily against our home product. One by one, the management of the noble houses of Great Britain is passing into the hands of our fair cousins from across the Atlantic. An important addition has now been made to the list of prizes which have been borne away by these charming invaders. Lord St. Simon, who has shown himself for over 20 years proof against the little god's arrows, has now definitely announced his approaching marriage with Miss Hattie Doran, the fascinating daughter of a Californian millionaire. Miss Doran, whose graceful figure and striking face attracted much attention at the Westbury House festivities, is an only child, and it is currently reported that her dowry will run to considerably over six figures. As it is an open secret that the Duke of Balmoral has been compelled to sell his pictures within the last few years, and as Lord St. Simon has no property, save the small estate at Birchmore, it is obvious that the Californian heiress is not the only gainer by an alliance which will enable her to make the easy and common transition from a Republican lady to a British title.
Anything more?
Yes, plenty. There's a note here to say that the marriage would be an absolutely quiet one at St. George's, Hanover Square, and that the party would return to the furnished house at Lancaster Gate after being taken over by Mr. Aloysius Doran. Now then, 2 days later, that's Wednesday last, there's a curt announcement that the wedding had taken place. Well, those are all the notices that appeared before the disappearance of the bride.
Before the what?
The vanishing of the lady.
When did she vanish, then?
At the wedding breakfast.
Indeed. This is more interesting than it promised to be. Quite dramatic, in fact.
Yes. It struck me as being a little out of the common.
They often vanish before the ceremony, and occasionally during the honeymoon. But I cannot call to mind anything quite so prompt as this. But there is a ring at the bell. And as the clock makes it a few minutes after four, I have no doubt that this will prove to be our noble client. No, do not dream of going, Watson. I very much prefer having a witness, if only as a check to my own memory. I would not have missed this case for worlds.
Lord Robert St. Simon.
Good day, Lord St. Simon. Pray take the basket chair. This is my friend and colleague, Dr. Watson. Draw up a little to the fire, and we shall talk this matter over.
A most painful matter to me, as you can most readily imagine, Mr. Holmes. I've been cut to the quick. I understand you have already managed several delicate cases of this sort, sir, though I presume that they were hardly from the same class of society.
No, I am descending.
I beg your pardon?
My last client of the sort was a king.
Oh, really? I had no idea. And which king?
The King of Scandinavia.
What, had he lost his wife?
You can understand that I extend to the affairs of my other clients the same secrecy which I promised to do in yours.
Oh, of course. Very right. I'm sure I beg your pardon. As to my own case, I am ready to give you any information which may assist you in forming an opinion.
Thank you. I've already learned something of it from the public prints. Nothing more. I think I may arrive at my facts most directly by questioning you.
Pray do so.
When did you first meet Miss Hattie Doran?
In San Francisco, a year ago.
Did you become engaged then?
No.
But you were on a friendly footing.
I was amused by her society, and she could see that I was amused.
Her father is very rich?
He is said to be the richest man on the Pacific Slope.
And how did he make his money?
In mining. He had nothing a few years ago. Then he struck gold, invested it, and came up by leaps and bounds.
Now, what is your own impression as to the young lady's... your wife's character?
You see, Mr. Holmes, my wife was 20 before her father became a rich man. During that time, she ran free in a mining camp, so that her education has come from nature rather than from the schoolmaster. She's what we call in England a tomboy. She is impetuous, volcanic, I was about to say. On the other hand, I would not have given her the name which I have the honor to bear had I not thought her to be at bottom a noble woman.
The young lady came to London then, and you renewed your acquaintance.
Yes, her father brought her over for this last season. I met her several times. We became engaged, and I have now married her.
She brought, I understand, a considerable dowry.
Not more than is usual in my family.
And this, of course, remains to you, since the marriage is a fait accompli.
I really have made no inquiries on the subject.
Very naturally not. On the morning of the wedding, was she in good spirits?
Never better. She was as bright as possible, until after the ceremony.
And did you observe any change in her then?
Well, to tell the truth, I saw then the first signs that her temper was a little sharp. The incident was too trivial to relate, though. It can have no possible bearing on the case.
Pray let us have it for all that.
Oh, it is childish. She dropped her bouquet as we went towards the vestry. She was passing the front pew at the time, and it fell over into the pew. There was a moment's delay, but the gentleman in the pew handed it up to her again. It didn't appear to be the worse for the fall, and when I spoke to her about it, she answered me abruptly. In the carriage on our way home, she seemed absurdly agitated over so trifling a cause.
Indeed. You say that there was a gentleman in the pew. Some of the general public were present then?
Oh, yes. It is impossible to exclude them when the church is open.
This gentleman was one of your wife's friends.
Oh, no. I called him a gentleman by courtesy. He was quite a common-looking person. I hardly noted his appearance. But really, I think we are wandering rather from the point.
At any rate, Lady St. Simon returned from the wedding in a less cheerful frame of mind than she had gone to it. What did she do on re-entering her father's house?
I saw her in close conversation with her maid, Alice.
A confidential servant?
A little too much so. She is an American. She came from California with her. It seemed to be that her mistress allowed her to take great liberties. Still, of course, in America, they look upon these things in a different way.
You did not overhear what they said?
Lady St. Simon said something about jumping a claim. She was accustomed to using slang of that kind. I've no idea what she meant.
American slang is very expressive sometimes. And what did your wife do next?
She walked into the breakfast room.
On your arm?
No, alone. She was very independent in little matters like that. Then after we'd sat down for 10 minutes or so, she rose hurriedly, muttered some words of apology, and left the room. She never came back. Her maid says she went to her room, covered her bride's dress with a long ulster, put on a bonnet, and went out. One of the footmen remembered seeing a lady leave, but he refused to credit that it could have been his mistress. He naturally believed that she was inside.
Quite so.
Afterwards, my wife is said to have been seen walking into Hyde Park with the woman who had caused the disturbance earlier on.
The disturbance?
Yes. After we'd returned from the church, this woman apparently tried to follow us into the house. She had to be ejected by the butler and the footman.
Why should she want to force her way in?
Well, Mr. Holmes, she claimed, she and I... Well, to tell the truth, her name is Flora Miller. She used to be danseuse at the Allegro. I have not treated her ungenerously, but she's no just cause for complaint against me. Do you know what women are, Mr. Holmes? She wrote me dreadful letters when she heard I was to be married. In fact, the reason I had the marriage celebrated so quietly was because I feared there might be a scandal at the church. Fortunately, I had given instructions to the servants at the house, and they soon pushed her out.
Did your wife hear all this?
No, thank goodness she didn't.
And yet she was seen walking with this very woman afterwards.
Yes, Mr. Lestrade of Scotland Yard looks upon it as very serious. It is thought that Flora decoyed my wife out and laid some terrible trap for her. I understand that she is now in custody.
Well, it is a possible supposition.
Oh, you think so too? Oh, I don't think Flora would hurt a fly.
I didn't say a probable one. Still, jealousy is a strange transformer of characters. Pray then, Lord St. Simon, what is your own theory as to what took place?
Well, really, I came to seek a theory, not to propound one. Now, since you ask me, however, it has occurred to me that the excitement, the consciousness that she had made so immense a social stride may have caused some little nervous disturbance in my life.
In short, that she had become suddenly deranged.
Well, when I consider that she has turned her back, I will not say upon me, but upon so much that many have aspired to without reason, I can hardly explain it in any other fashion.
Well, that is certainly a conceivable hypothesis. And now, Lord St. Simon, I think I have nearly all my data. May I ask whether you and your wife were seated at the breakfast table so you could see out of the window?
We could see the other side of the road and the park.
Quite so. Then I do not think I need detain you any longer. I will communicate with you.
Should you be fortunate enough to solve this problem?
I have solved it.
Eh? What was that?
I say, I have solved it.
Where, then, is my wife?
That is a detail which I shall speedily supply.
Yes, I'm afraid it will take wiser heads than yours or mine. Good day to you, gentlemen.
Ah, It's very good of Lord St. Simon to honor my head by putting it on a level with his own. Well, I think I shall have a whiskey and soda and a cigar after all that cross-questioning. I had formed my conclusions as to the case before our client was nearly done. I have notes of several similar cases, though as I remarked before, none of them was quite as prompt. My whole examination has turned my conjecture into a certainty. Circumstantial evidence is occasionally very convincing, as when, to quote Thoreau's example, you find a trout in the milk.
But I've heard all you've heard.
Without, however, the knowledge of pre-existing cases which serves me so well. There was a parallel instance in Aberdeen some years back, and there was something on very much the same lines at Munich, the year after the Franco-Prussian War. It is one of those cases... But hello, here's the straight. You will find an extra tumbler on the sideboard. There are cigars in the box.
Thank you. Evening, Dr. Watson.
Good evening to you.
What's up, then? You look dissatisfied.
And I feel dissatisfied. It's this infernal St. Simon marriage case. I can't make head or tail of the business.
Really? You surprise me.
Oh, whoever heard of such a mixed affair? Every clue seems to slip through my fingers. I've been at work on it all day.
And very wet it seems to have made you.
I've been dragging the serpentine.
In heaven's name, what for?
Looking for the body of Lady St. Simon.
Have you dragged the basin of the Trafalgar Square fountain?
Why? What do you mean?
Because you've just as good a chance of finding this lady there as in the Serpentine.
Oh, I suppose you know all about it.
Well, I have only just heard the facts, but my mind is made up.
Oh, indeed. Then you think that the Serpentine plays no part in the matter?
I think it is very unlikely.
Then perhaps you'll kindly explain how it is we found this in it. There's a little nut for you to crack, Master Holmes.
Indeed. See, Watson, a wedding dress, white satin shoes, a bride's wreath and veil.
And a wedding ring.
You dragged these from the Serpentine?
No. They were found near the bank by a park keeper. They were identified as her clothes. And it seemed to me that if the clothes were there, the body wouldn't be far off.
By the same brilliant reasoning, every man's body is to be found in the neighborhood of his wardrobe. And pray, what did you hope to arrive at through this?
Some evidence implicating Flora Miller in the disappearance.
I'm afraid you will find it difficult.
Oh, are you indeed? No. And I'm afraid, Holmes, that you're not very practical with your deductions and your inference. This dress does implicate Miss Flora Miller.
And how?
In the dress is a pocket. In the pocket is a card case. In the card case is a note. Just listen to this. You will see me when all is ready. Come at once, F.H.M. Now, my theory all along has been that Lady St. Simon was decoyed away by Flora Miller, no doubt with Confederates. Her initials are on this note. It was, no doubt, slipped into the bride's hand at the door, and it lured her into their reach.
Very good, Lestrade. You really are very fine indeed. Let me see it. Ah, this is indeed important.
Oh, you find it so?
Extremely. I congratulate you warmly.
Well, then. Well, you're looking on the wrong side.
On the contrary, this is the right side.
The right side? You're mad. Here is the note written in pencil over here.
And over here is what appears to be a fragment of an hotel bill. It interests me deeply.
No, there's nothing in that. I looked at it before. October the 4th, rooms 8 shillings. Breakfast 2 and 6, cocktail 1 shilling. Lunch 2 and 6, glass of sherry 8 pence. I see nothing in that.
Very likely not. It's most important all the same. As for the note, it's important also, or at least the initials are. So I congratulate you again.
No, I've wasted time enough. I believe in hard work, not sitting by the fire spinning theories. We shall see who gets to the bottom of this first. Good day to you, Mr. Holmes.
Just one hint to you, Lestrade. I will tell you the true solution of this matter. Lady St. Simon is a myth. There is not, and there never has been, any such person.
Mad. Mad.
But there is something in what the fellow says about outdoor work. I think, Watson, I must leave you to your papers for a little. Well, Watson, They have laid the supper in my absence, I see.
Yes, I didn't know what it was all about. A confectioner's man came and set it all out. Cold woodcock, pheasant, pâté de foie gras pie, and some bottles. Said it had been paid for and ordered to this address.
Capital.
Yes, he's late for five. You seem to expect company.
Yes, I fancy we may have some company dropping in. I'm surprised Lord St. Simon has not already arrived. Ah, I fancy I hear his step on the stairs now. My message reached you then.
Yes, but I must confess the contents startle me beyond measure. Have you good authority for what you say?
The best possible.
Oh, what will the Duke say? What's he to think when he hears that one of the family has been subjected to such humiliation?
It is the purest accident.
You look on these things from another standpoint.
I can hardly see how the lady could have acted otherwise. Her abrupt method of doing it was undoubtedly to be regretted. But having no mother, she had no one to advise her at such a crisis.
It was a slight, sir, a public slight.
You must make allowance for this poor girl, placed in so unprecedented a position.
I will make no allowance. I am very angry indeed. I have been shamefully used.
I think I heard a ring. Yes, there are steps on the landing. If I cannot persuade you to take a lenient view, Lord St. Simon, I have brought an advocate here who may be more successful. Lord St. Simon, allow me to introduce you to Mr. and Mrs. Francis Hay Moulton. Lady, I think you have already met.
You're angry, rather. Well, I guess you have every cause to be.
Pray, make no apology to me.
Oh, yes, I know I treated you real bad. I should have spoken to you before I went, but I was kind of rattled. From the time I first met you again, I just didn't know what I was doing or saying. I only wonder I didn't fall down and go upstairs right there before the altar.
Mrs. Moulton, perhaps you would like my friend and me to leave the room while you explain this matter.
If I may give an opinion, we've had just a little too much secrecy over this matter already. For my part, I'd like all Europe and America to hear the rights of it.
Then I'll tell our story right away. Frank and I met in 81 in McGuire's camp near the Rockies, where Paul was working on a claim. We were engaged, Frank and I. But then one day, Paul struck a rich parkhead and made a pile, while poor Frank here had a claim that came to nothing. The richer Paul grew, the poorer Frank got. So at last, Paul wouldn't hear of our engagement lasting any longer, and he took me away to Frisco. Frank wouldn't throw up his hand, though.
You bet.
So Frank followed me and saw me without Paul knowing. He said he would go back and make his pile, too, and he wouldn't come to claim me till he had as much as Pa. So I promised to wait for him till the end of time, and not to marry anyone else as long as he lived.
So I said, why shouldn't we be married straight away, then? Then I'll feel sure of you. But I won't claim to be your husband till I come back. Well, we talked it over, see, and we just went to a clergyman and did it right there.
Well,
the next I heard of Frank was he was in Montana, then in New Mexico. Then there was a newspaper story about how a miner's camp had been attacked by the Apache Indians. And there was Frank's name among the killed. I was sick for months. There was never another word of Frank after that. Well, then Lord St. Simon, Robert, came to Frisco. We came to London, and a marriage was fixed.
You see, I was...
Hold on, dear. I felt all the time that no man on this earth could ever take Frank's place in my heart. But I meant to make Robert just as good a wife as it was in me to be. But you imagine what I felt first as I came to the altar rails. There was Frank, standing looking at me out of the first pew. Well, I thought it was his ghost at first, but I looked again, and there he was still, with a kind of question in his eyes. I didn't know if to stop the service and make a scene in the church. What the clergyman was saying was just like a bee buzzing in my ears.
I scribbled her a note,
yes,
and it...
on the way out again, I saw the piece of paper in his hand, and I knew it was for me. So as I passed the pew, I dropped my bouquet over, and he slipped the note into my hand when he gave it back.
You never doubted for a moment that your first duty was to him?
Of course. Well, I told my maid to say nothing and got a few things packed. I know I ought to have said something to Robert, but it was dreadful hard in front of his mother and all those great people. I just made up my mind to run away and explain afterwards. I hadn't been at the table 10 minutes when I saw Frank out in the road. I slipped out and followed him into the park. Some woman came up talking something about Lord St. Simon, but I managed to get away from her. I caught up with Frank, and we took a cab to his place in Gordon Square. And that was my true wedding, after all these years.
You see, I've been a prisoner with those Apaches all the time. When I got back to Frisco, I saw in the paper about this other wedding. I just got to England in time.
Frank was all for being open and telling what had happened. But I was so ashamed thinking of all those lords and ladies waiting at that table for me to come back. So Frank took my wedding things and dropped them anywhere in the park he thought they wouldn't be found. We were off to Paris tomorrow. Only this gentleman, Mr. Holmes, came round. Well, Robert, you've heard it all, and I'm very sorry if I've given you pain. I hope you don't think very meanly of me.
Excuse me, but it is not my custom to discuss my most intimate personal affairs in this public manner.
Then you won't forgive me? You won't shake hands before I go?
Oh, certainly. If it would give you any pleasure.
I had hoped that you would have joined us in a friendly supper.
I think that there you ask a little too much. I may be forced to acquiesce in these recent developments, but I can hardly be expected to make merry over them. I think that with your permission, I will now wish you all a very good night.
Then I trust that you, at least, will honor us with your company. It is always a joy to meet an American, Mr. Moulton. I'm one of those who believe that the folly of a monarch and the blundering of a minister in foregone years will not prevent our children from being someday citizens of the same worldwide country under a flag which will be a quartering of the Union Jack with the stars and stripes. Well, good night, Mr. Moulton. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Well, Holmes.
Yes, the case has been an interesting one. It shows how simple the explanation may be of an affair which seems almost inexplicable at first sight.
You had no doubt then?
From the first, two facts were obvious to me. One was that the lady was quite willing to undergo the marriage ceremony. The other was that she had repented of it within a few minutes of returning home. But she could not have spoken to anyone when she was out, for she had been in the company of the bridegroom. Had she seen someone then? If she had, it must have been someone from America. She'd spent too little time in this country for anyone to acquire so deep an influence over her that the mere sight of him would induce her to change her plans.
I see.
By a process of exclusion, we have arrived at the idea that she might have seen an American. Then who could he be? He might be a lover. He might be a husband. When St. Simon told us of a man in the pew, and the change in her manner, and that transparent device of dropping her bouquet, it all became absolutely clear. Especially in view of that allusion of hers to claim jumping, which in miners' talk means taking possession of that which another person has prior right to. It was clear to me that she had gone off with a man, and the chances were in favor of his being a husband.
And how in the world did you find them?
Friend Lestrade held information in his hands and didn't know the value of it. The initials on the note were of the highest importance, of course. But it was more valuable still to know that within a week he had settled his bill at one of the most select hotels in London.
How did you deduce the select?
By the select prices. 8 shillings for a bed and 8 pence for a glass of sherry pointed to one of the most expensive hotels. There are not so many in London which charge at that rate. In the second one I visited in Northumberland Avenue, I learned by an inspection of the book that Francis H. Moulton, an American gentleman, had left only the day before. On looking over the entries against him, I came upon the very items I had seen in the duplicate bill. His letters were to be forwarded to 226 Gordon Square. So thither I travelled. The loving couple were fortunately at home, and I ventured to give them some paternal advice. I invited them to meet Lord St. Simon here, and make their position a little clearer.
But with no very good results. His conduct was certainly not very gracious.
In The Noble Bachelor, as Sherlock Holmes and Mr. Dr. Watson, you heard Robert Langford and Kenneth Baker. Others in the cast were Edna Jacobson, Bruce Anderson, Louis Ife, and Roger Spence. There'll be another Sherlock Holmes adventure at the same time next week.